Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cirka 2000 milliarder kroner det Oaktree har under forvaltning. Og deres grunnlegger og jeg vil ikke si eneste forvalter, det mange forvaltere der, men den viktigste forvalteren har jeg tilbrakt en halvtime med, i hvert fall virtuelt nå i dag. Jeg hadde et intervju med han nå, tok vel en, jeg vet ikke om det var 4 måneder å planlegge eller noe sånt, og en sånn hel skoleklasse med PR-folk, men vi fikk det i orden, og det var akkurat så bra som jeg trodde det skulle være. Du har akkurat hørt intervjuet nå, Peter. Hva du synes om samtalen?
Ja, jeg bare misunnelig, så det første reaksjon. Jeg synes det var veldig bra. Han går inn på dette, at han skriver dette memo som både er tilgjengelig i skriftlig form, men som også legges ut som lydfiler. Så som han er jo kjent med, og mye av det han snakker om kjenner jeg igjen. Men du får det liksom fra the horse's mouth, og samtidig så får du hans lærdom da. Og for så vidt noen av hans utfordringer som han kommer inn på inadvertently, altså rett og slett fordi han forteller en historie. Men en ting jeg bet meg merke til, og det er jo, altså han snakker jo om at verdien av å sitte i ro og klare å sitte med gode investeringer over tid. Du kom jo inn på dette med han, og hva er det som får han til å beslutte og forandre mening, altså eller rett og slett gå ut av en posisjon. Men han snakker jo om det langsiktige, og at hvis du går tilbake og ser på noen av de virkelig store suksesshistoriene når det gjelder utviklinger på selskaper, eller aksjekursutviklingen på selskaper, så har man måttet tåle betydelig ubehag i løpet av den historien, altså i løpet av den tiden hvor selskapet har eksistert. Men så begynner han å fortelle om det nifty 50, altså disse blue chip selskapene som var der helt i begynnelsen av hans karriere, og som, jeg husker ikke om han sa, over et tidsløp, alle, altså det var det alle skulle ha, man skulle ikke være mer avansert eller mer aktiv enn det, enn å kjøpe disse. Jeg tror han sier at de falt 90-95% eller et eller annet sånt, altså noe som sendte han riktig nok på en annen karriere, fordi han hadde ansvaret for dette, ikke at han gjorde noe galt, men det var det man skulle sitte med. Men det fikk meg også til å reflektere litt over den lærdommen han får senere, fordi det er en ting er å sitte i ro, altså når er, altså det er greit å bestemme seg for å være langsiktig, som han gjør, men det krever mer enn det, for å kunne være langsiktig, det krever jo at du har kunnskap, at du følger opp og så videre, slik at du vet forskjellen på når du skal, når det er på tide å komme deg ut, av et selskap, fordi rett og slett ikke leverer etter de forventningene du hadde, eller det skifter businessmodell, eller hva som helst. Så det er ikke bare å sitte i ro, det er jo egentlig poenget mitt, og det kommer jo for så vidt frem i det han sier også. Så det er jo et hav av lærdom. Og ikke minst så forsterker han jo noe som vi har snakket om, og det er at du må investere i forhold til, altså med en strategi som reflekterer hvem du er, og ikke ta på deg en strategi som rett og slett føles fremmed for deg, og som rett og slett påfører deg såpass mye ubehag at du ikke klarer å holde strategien. Så det er som med alt annet i livet, det er viktig at man gjør ting som stemmer overens med den man er, da. Den man er egentlig psykologisk, for det er det handler om, og det handler ikke om å ha en riktig eller gal psykologi i utgangspunktet, eller mental innstilling, eller kall det hva du vil, eller emosjonell, fordi det er det også handler om. Det har egentlig med at investere i forhold til den du har. Det er ikke noe galt med den du har, det er ikke det at du skal forandre den, det er en voldsom prosess hvis så kreves. Men at du investerer i forhold til det, og da blir reisen din veldig mye mer behagelig enn om du går mot den. Og jeg føler jo at Howard Marks er inne på alle disse kjernepunktene, mye takket være de spørsmålene som du stiller han, som jeg synes var veldig gode, og som han også for øvrig selv synes var gode, men det gjør at du får ut det beste av han, og det som jeg oppfatter og tror er verdifullt for våre lyttere.
Jeg synes det er artig med historie, fra to perspektiver da, for at jeg bruker ofte å lese historier om finans, og veldig interessert i finanshistorie, har alltid vært det. Men det er noe annet når det blir fortalt. Og Nifty 50 er et ganske bra eksempel på det, fordi at når han sa Nifty 50, jeg tenkte det var indiske aksjer med en gang. Og det er den indiske indeksen som heter det. Den her Nifty 50 var jo en langt mer uformell variant. Men,
Helt riktig.
Nei, og det er det som er så fint med å kunne snakke med. Altså, han her er jo filosof. Det her er høyt nivå på analysen. Det er, og det er at han casually kan name-droppe Warren Buffett og andre, ikke som han har lest i bok eller sett på CNBC, er jo litt spesielt, selvfølgelig.
Men dette er jo en person som gjennom karrieren har møtt motgang, og har blitt sendt på nye tangenter i livet, om du vil, da, ikke sant? Altså, det er jo, man sier jo at når en dør lukker seg, så åpner en annen seg. For ham så har det jo virkelig vært det. Og det har jo formet han og gitt han ytterligere skillsets som har bidratt til å gjøre ham til den vanvittig dyktige investoren som han er. Så når man lærer noe, altså om det er smertefull, man har en smertefull erfaring, så er jo den fullstendig bortkastet hvis man ikke tar til seg lærdommen fra den og sier at, vet du hva, ok, det der gjorde skikkelig vondt, men her er det lærdom. Jeg vet at det der skal jeg, akkurat det jeg gjorde der, eller den inngangen der, eller hvordan jeg fulgte opp den investeringen, det er helt opplagt feil måte å gjøre det på når jeg ser det i retrospekt. Og så lærer man av det, og så passer man på å ikke begå de samme feilene om igjen. Det er veldig vanskelig, i hvert fall hvis du er aktiv, så er det veldig vanskelig å ikke gå, fordi det handler så mye om menneskelig psyke, men det er essensielt hvis du skal lykkes over tid.
Men skal vi si at vi starter opptaket nå, kanskje?
Ja, det vi kan gjøre er jo på en måte invitere lytterne til å sette seg godt tilbake i stolen. Ta bort alle distraksjoner som du har. Ikke driv og se på Facebook og Instagram og Snapchat eller whatever du driver med samtidig. Lukk øynene, lytt og lær.
Her er Howard Marks. So my first question is, I've heard you tell a little bit about your life story, but often there's a lot of coincidences behind your life choices. Do you remember the reason you ended up as an asset manager and your focus on credit on the debt markets?
Well, of course, the question is how far back to go. But And I've been thinking, you know, I'm a believer in luck, as you know, and you hear the word coincidence. I was told last year that God invented coincidence so he can remain anonymous. You know, what was the pivotal point? Well, when I was 16 years old in high school, one of my buddies said, they're starting a course in advanced accounting. We should take that. So I took accounting in high school. I love that. I wanted to go to Wharton. That made me decide in that direction before I hadn't given it a thought. I was told that I wouldn't get into Wharton, but my grades in accounting were so high, and the accounting teacher was the tennis coach, and he made me the tennis manager, and he wrote a very strong letter that got me into Wharton. So I went to Wharton to study accounting, and then I took finance, and I enjoyed that more, and switched my major to finance, and then I went for an MBA at University of Chicago. There I took accounting, but I learned most of what I know about investing at Chicago, not Wharton. And then, as you know, when I got out of school in 1969, I started work at Citibank as an equity analyst, and that was the normal course then, and most investing, you know, being an investor, mostly meant the stock market. The bank was devoted to what was called the Nifty 50 approach, invested in the 50 best companies in America. And if you bought those stocks the day I got there in September of 69, and you held them firmly for 5 years, you lost over 90% of your money. And I was associated with that that record. So I always say I'm lucky I didn't get fired. My boss said to me, I'd like you to move to the bond department and start a convertible bond fund. And the bond department was Siberia. I was being exiled, as you would say, north of the Arctic Circle. And but I went there and I started it and I loved it, because as opposed to knowing two sentences on 400 companies, now I only had to know everything about 20 companies. Much more exciting. And then, so that was May of 78. And then in August of 78, I got a call from the head of the bond department. And he said, there's some guy named Milken or something out in California, and he deals with something they call high yield bonds. Do you think you can figure out what that means? And that was my lucky day. So I started Citibank's high yield bond fund in November of 78. And I believe it was the first high yield bond fund from a mainstream financial institution. What a great place to be. What an advantage it was to be first in line. And so I was doing that from 78, and it was very successful. By the way, as opposed to the Nifty 50, now I'm investing in the worst public companies in America, and I'm making money steadily and safely. So what I learned is it's not what you buy, it's what you pay. And that good investing is not a matter of buying good things, but buying things well. And you have to extend that way of thinking to asset classes. And then in 1985, I switched from Citibank to TCW, Trust Company of the West at that time. And in 87, a friend of mine introduced me to Bruce Karsh, who was a young lawyer who wanted to get in the investment business. And he came to join me at TCW. And he had this idea to start a distressed debt fund to invest. You know, I mean, I had been in high yield bonds now 9 years. I've bought some bonds, many of them, most of them paid interest and principal as promised, but a few of them I bought at 100. They went bankrupt. They fell to 10. You went on the creditors committee. You worked hard to restructure them and you got 30. So Bruce's idea was, why don't we just do the 10 to 30 part? And so again, I had the opportunity with Bruce to start, I think, the first distressed debt fund from a mainstream financial institution, and another piece of good luck. That's just one example.
I read that when you went into equities, you started as an analyst. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
That's a very different thing from carrying the risk of the trades. Do you find that the analyst traits and things you learn are transferable, or are they so different that it could be different leagues, like or different sports? I mean,
well, the analytical part of the job is very important to figure out what to buy and to have a sense for fundamental value. But then, as you say, the portfolio manager aspect of the job is actually putting the decisions to work and bearing the risk and living with the ups and downs. The analyst lives with the consequences of his or her recommendation, but actually making the buy-sell decision and living with it is more. Now, I'm not a big risk taker, and so I'm lucky I got into the bond world where the risks are containable and where the performance is pretty much foreseeable. Then when Bruce and I went into the distressed debt business, he supplied his, shall we say, boldness and took on the actual portfolio management decisions, and he did a great job. So I think your question is getting at a very interesting topic. We say in American sports, we say, oh, that guy's doing well. He's playing within himself. He's doing the things that he can really do. And that's important for anybody in any walk of life, and especially in investing, where it's the basis of the job is taking risk.
Speaking of that, you don't make many public calls. A lot of people talk about things they think will happen. I have listened to you many, many hours, and I think I've heard you make one very distinct call earlier this year, or yet last year, I mean, within the last 6 months. How was this time different, and why did you feel the need to make such a... It wasn't really a prediction, now that I think about it, but how did you come to that notion too? Because you have your voice speaks very loudly.
Sure. Well, you know, back in 2018, we published a book called Mastering the Market Cycle. And when I was writing that, I checked with my son, who's a venture capitalist, brilliant investor, and my advisor. And so I said, Andrew, I think my market calls have been about right over the course of my career. And he said, yes, Dad, that's because you did it 5 times in 50 years. You know, 5 times I found the market was crazy high or crazy low, and you could compellingly reach a decision about what was smart to do. In between, not so much. And so it has been very infrequent, and the infrequency has permitted it to be right. But if I would have tried 50 times or 500 times or 5,000 times, my correctness would probably converge with a coin toss at 50-50. Now, the one you're talking about was not a market call, but it was an observation with regard to the environment. I wasn't saying buy or sell. But what I was saying is that if you came into this business since 1980, you pretty much have only seen declining interest rates or ultra low interest rates. And that has had a profound impact on investments over this period of time. But so below the surface and so gradual over such a long period of time that most people don't recognize it. But it has helped investors. It has helped borrowers. So it doubly helped people who made investments using borrowed money. It hurt savers. It hurt lenders. It hurt bargain hunters, because by keeping the markets aloft, you make it harder to find bargains. So it had a very profound impact on the investment environment. My point that I made in a memo called Sea Change in December 22 and have made since is that I think that's over. Interest rates are not going to go down terribly far from here. I don't think we're going back to the zero that was the Fed funds rate for most of the time from the beginning of 09 to the end of 2022, or the 0.5% that I think prevailed on average over that 13-year period. So interest rates will not be declining much. They will not be as low as they were, which means that the beneficial effects on certain investment strategies and the negative effect on others will not equally be the case. Now, people who lived through the 40 years from 1980 to 2020, they think that that was normal. And that's what they'll always see. That's human nature, is to think that what you have lived through is normalcy. But it's not. And you have to be as old as I am. You have to be able to remember the 70s and the 60s to think about high and rising interest rates. And I'm not saying that interest rates in the future will be high and rising. They'll be moderate and steady, as opposed to the declining and ultra low rates of the recent past.
So I have a follow-up question. I know you mentioned this somewhat, but there is a caveat to your investment thesis. You have to avoid losers. You have to avoid defaults. Is there a way to do that?
Well, first of all, let me clarify. That's my approach for me and for Oaktree. I'm not saying that's the only way. There are people who are high volatility investors who are hyper-aggressive activities. They have winners which are so big that they offset the occasional loser. That's not an invalid strategy. In fact, where are the highest rates of return in the investment world achieved? And the answer is by successful people working in venture capital. And if you're in venture capital, and I may exaggerate here, but in venture capital, you expect 90, 80, 70, maybe 60% of your investments to be worthless. But you expect that you'll have a few hundred times winners, which will offset that and make you a big success. And people who work at firms in Silicon Valley like Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia and Benchmark have very, very high rates of return, much higher than Oaktree. So their approach in their field is to go for winners. And if you go for winners and get a few, you can be very successful. In my field of this debt, you don't have any 100 timesers or very, and almost no 10 timesers. So the route to success has to be the elimination of losers, not the achievement of huge successes. So that's right for my asset class. The other thing is, it's right for me because my personality is conservative. My approach is analytical. I'm not a futurist. I'm not a great optimist. If that boss back in 78 had said, Howard, I want you to start a venture capital fund, and when Amazon is invented in 20 years, I want you to be the one who finds it, it would have been a disaster because it wouldn't have fit my abilities, skill set, and personality. So for me, I think you're alluding to a memo I wrote this past summer called Fewer Losers or More Winners. And for me, that was the route to success, not for everybody. Having said that, it is possible to reduce, not eliminate, the losers so that you have very few detractors from your record. Now, Oaktree, this is not me. This is Oaktree. But Oaktree record in high yield bonds, our default rate has been about 30%. Of the default rate in the universe. So, the average investor bought 100 bonds and 4 defaulted every year on average. For us, we bought 100 bonds and on average, just over 1 defaulted every year. So you can do it if you have the right thinkers and the right approach.
Speaking of your memo, you refer back to memo. I refer to your memos. Everyone refers to your memos.
Thank you.
And your first memo was written, I think, October 12th, 1990.
Right.
Can you tell us about it if you remember it? And well, do you remember why you started doing it?
Vaguely. But that's the right question because we're talking about fewer losers or more winners. And that was really the subject of that first memo in 1990, which was called The Route to Success. I had dinner with a client of mine, Dave Van Benskoten, who sounds maybe Norwegian. He was the head of the General Mills Pension Fund. And he had done it for 14 years. And he told me that in the 14 years, General Mills's holdings of equities were never above the 27th percentile or below the 47th percentile. So that means that for 14 consecutive years, it was solidly in the second quartile. Never highly superior, but never below average. Now, if you do that for 14 years in a row, 27 to 47, where do you come out for the whole 14-year period? You must know the answer. But I think that the layman would say, well, if you range from 27 to 47, you probably average around 37. General Mills for the 14 years was fourth percentile. Now, how can that be? And the answer, what dawned on me when I read about this, or when I had the discussion with Dave, was they never shot themselves in the foot. They never had a ruinous year that ruins your record. You know, the math in investing is very strange. Let's say in a given year, you're down 75%. You start with $100 and you end up with 25. You have to make 300% to make that up, to turn 25 back into 100. And if you do that, if you're down 75% one year and up 300% the next year, which is an enormous accomplishment, you're only back to even. You haven't made any money. So I think the conversation with Dave was very formative in my investment approach, although I think I had been risk averse and aiming to reduce the losers even before that dinner in 1990. I'd been investing already for 20 years. But it convinced me that that's the way for me to achieve. And in fact, in December of 22, the Financial Times of London runs a column every Saturday called Lunch with the FT. And they take somebody to lunch, not often investment people. They're trying to get away from having just boring investing people. But they take somebody to lunch and then they write a column about the person, the restaurant, and the food. So they took me to lunch in December of 22, and I took the reporter to my favorite Italian restaurant near my office here in New York. And we were sitting there, and I said, you know, eating here is like investing at Oak Tree. Always good, sometimes great, never terrible. Now, to me, at first look, that sounds like a modest statement, not too powerful a statement. But to me, for me, that's the best you can do. It would be nice to be great all the time, but you can't be because sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes events in the world, unpredictable events in the world, go against you. Sometimes your strategy or your asset class is out of favor. And you can't succeed no matter what you do. So you can't have a great year every year. But if you can have a good year every year, a decent year every year, and have a great year once in a while when the stars align, but never have a disaster, you'll have a very good record. You know, my investment career, since I switched to active portfolio management in bonds, is now in its 46th year. And I think that that describes that career is always decent and sometimes great, but never terrible. And I'm very happy with that. And I think it's the most that most people can aspire to.
Regarding, I'm not sure you consider your investments trades in any way, or entering a trade or exiting a trade, but how do you change your mind or think that you've gone far enough? How do you exit a trade, or how do you figure out that it's gone so far, everything I thought has happened, or it will never happen? Do you understand my question?
Right. Sure, sure. Well, that's a great question. When I'm in Europe and people hear that I'm in the investment management business, they say, oh, what do you trade? It doesn't happen very much. Maybe the word trade is not used as much in the US, or maybe people use the word trade the way I do in the US, but not in Europe. They say, what do you trade? I said, I don't trade. I invest. Trading to me is you buy something because you think it's going up tomorrow. If it goes up, you sell it and you buy something else that you think will go up the next day. And your attention span, your holding period, is really delimited in days or weeks. To me, an investor, and I didn't invent this, this is really the foundation of Warren Buffett's value approach. The investor finds a business that he wants to own piece of for years and ties his wagon, if you will, to that business, and does not expect to sell it if it goes up in a week. I wrote a memo on liquidity. By the way, we're talking about the memos. We should tell all the listeners that all the memos are available at www.oaktreecapital.com under the heading of Insights. You can read the last 35 years worth or subscribe to the future ones. And the one thing I know of is that the price is right because they're free. And so I wrote a memo on liquidity about 7 years ago, when people were thinking that the markets had become less liquid. And my son, who I mentioned before, gave me a great quote for that. We were talking about it. And he says, Dad, if you see the chart of a stock that's been up for 25 years, and you say, man, I wish I held that stock, just think how many days you would have had to talk yourself out of selling. Because I believe people sell too much. And as does Andrew. And so I wrote a memo. By the way, at this point, I can say I wrote a memo on just about every topic. But I wrote a memo about 3 years ago called Selling Out. Why do people sell? By the way, there are a million memos written about buying in the investment business. There are very few written about selling. Why do people sell? And I concluded somewhat facetiously that they sell because things go up and they sell because things go down. If it goes up, they're afraid it's going to go back down and they'll kick themselves or get fired. And if it goes down, they're afraid it's going to go down more and they'll kick themselves or get fired. So they trade too much in response to going up and going down. Now, how can it can't possibly be the correct decision to sell because things are up and sell because they're down. So that leads to the question that you asked. You know I would get there eventually. When do you sell? When do you decide it's done? And I think the best way to think of that is to think of it not as a decision to sell, but a decision to unbuy. You bought it once for a reason, hopefully a good reason. Now, at some point, you decide to unbuy it. In other words, you decide that the reasons you had for buying it are no longer in force. So you either decide that you thought you would get a certain amount of juice out of that orange and you've gotten it. You thought it would go up 40%, it's gone up 40%. By the way, the next step should always be to reevaluate your thesis, because you might it's gone 40, you thought it would go up 40%, it's gone up 40%. But if you study it, you might say, you know what, it's got another 30% in it. I'm not going to sell it. So you reevaluate your thesis. You say, my thesis hasn't changed. I thought it was going up 40, it went up 40. Now I sell. Or you say, it hasn't done anything or it's gone down. You reevaluate your thesis and you say, you know what, I no longer believe what I believed at the beginning. You sell. But so reevaluating your thesis and concluding that either you've gotten everything out of it that's to be gotten or your thesis is no longer valid, those are valid reasons to sell. But because it went up or because it went down is not a valid reason to sell. And in that memo, I think I mentioned, I think it was Amazon, which after the tech bubble burst around 2000 or 2001 was selling at $6 a share. So think about it. You say, now it goes to 12. You say, oh, it's a double. I'm out. I don't want it to go back to six. Well, I own it. So you sell. Or maybe it goes, you don't sell at 12 because you're a long-term investor and it goes to 60. How many people would continue to hold it at when it's up 10 times? So maybe you say, I'm going to take a few chips off the table and sell a little. Then it goes to 600. And you sell the rest. You feel stupid because you sold some at 60. You sell the rest, and now you're out. And at the time I wrote the memo, I think Amazon was 3,300. So if you sell every time something goes up, you'll never get to the big winners. And, you know, Warren Buffett says that he made all his money in 12 things. I was in his office and I saw the slip of paper on the wall where he typed out the financial statement for the first year of his fund's operation. He typed it himself. I think he had 100,000 under management. That was 53, I think. So he's been investing for 70 years, 70 years. He says he made all his money in 12 things. Charlie Munger, who just passed away, he came to investing a little later. So Charlie may have only invested for 60 years. And he said he made all his money in 4 things. So you can't expect to find a lot of great things in your life. The key is to find them, be open-minded, recognize them when you have them, and sit on your hands and hold as long as they should be held. That's the key. I had breakfast a week ago today with somebody who sold his company in 1977 and who was involved in the formation of another company in 78. And he's never sold a share of either one. And now he's one of the richest men in America. When I was a boy, there was a motto, don't just sit there, do something. But I think the real advice is don't just do something, sit there. And people equate activity with accomplishment or progress, but it's not. Sometimes you make the most progress by not being active.
Howard, I want to thank you so much for sitting down with us. And I promised you a half an hour. I don't want to extend my welcome, like you said. And thank you so much for taking this time. It's an incredible opportunity to get to hear you, your musings of it. And I know a lot of people listen to you on the podcast, and it's a pleasure to be able to ask you questions.
Well, your questions were good ones, so it was a pleasure to answer them. And you were patient. You sat still for some long answers. I'm glad I did it. I try to help people understand the essence of investing, and I write the memos and the books, and hopefully your podcast will help me spread the word.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.